The Global Energy Leaders Podcast, Episode 23.
Welcome to the Global Energy Leaders Podcast, powered by R Squared Global.
Welcome to another edition of the Global Energy Leaders Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Ryan Ray. So good to have you. And today we have on a special guest, we have on James Ellsmore, who is on the Forbes 30 Under 30 Energy List. James, how's it going today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just kind of get into that. How did that come about? How did you get your name in the hat? I was looking into this last night. I mean, you know, T. Boone Pickens, some other industry heavyweights go through this process of deciding who is worthy of this title. So tell me the story. How did this come about?
Yeah, and I thought it was especially interesting with someone like him on that getting in for renewables work, but it seems like they're fairly open to all different sides of the energy area. So I was based out in the Bay Area in Oakland, just outside San Francisco, and I've actually ended up working with quite a few other people who've been listed on the Forbes 30 Under 30 for energy. I worked with an incubator there for solar energy companies called Powerhouse, and quite a few people have come out of that have gone on to be listed by Forbes. So I knew various people that have been in it, and was really quite shocked in January when I got an email in my inbox saying it's gone live, you're on the website and you're on the list this year. And actually next week I'm heading off to Jerusalem for the annual conference that Forbes run there, where they invite all the people who've been lucky enough to receive the award. And so I'll be there for a 4-day conference, which I'm pretty excited about. I've not been to Israel before.
Oh, wow. That does sound exciting. So you mentioned solar there, renewables more specifically. What got you into renewables and, you know, solar energy? And we'll talk about what you've got going on in a second, but what was the draw for you to get into solar energy?
I've always been interested in the environment and renewable energy, and I grew up on a farm in rural England, and we actually, well, probably getting on for 10 years ago now, installed solar panels on our own farm buildings to generate electricity. And so I kind of, through that installation process and the process of looking at that, that sparked my interest. And from then on through college and since then, I've just really pursued that. And I think for me, solar is really the ultimate renewable energy source, you know, although I'm really interested in wind and hydro and other things. I think I'm just a really big fan of solar, and I think we're progressing so quickly. And in the last 5 years, things have moved on so quickly that it's just an exciting space to be in.
Yeah, and kind of how we got connected was you were listening to Dr. Joshua Pierce on one of our episodes, and you know, one of the things that he talked about was if you just look at the charts for solar energy production, it's really just the last handful of years, as far as actual a viable power entity, it's really taken off, and so it is exciting to see. And one of the questions that that I hear when I talk to solar professionals is, you know, when will the battery technology catch up to the solar technology? So what are you seeing as far as the battery technology being able to store the solar energy for a reasonable amount of time?
Yeah, well, for a start, I just wanted to say on your podcast, I love the wide range of views and opinions that you have. And it was really interesting listening to Dr. Pierce on solar. And on that point that you made about the speed of the price that solar's come down, just an anecdotal evidence of the own solar system that we installed on my parents' farm. Within 1 year of the installation, I think the price of that companies were quoting to do a similar install had halved in price. So we were kicking ourselves, but it's one of those things that, you know, prices are falling and changing so quickly, you never know when the right moment to enter is. Regarding the batteries, obviously, that's a huge that's the big thing for solar energy now. I think panels have got to a low enough price, and the technology has got high enough that we're not going to see huge breakthroughs in solar panels in the next couple of years. There's going to be incremental changes, but batteries is really the place to be looking at and seeing changes. And there's so much money going into that now and research to work out how we can best use them. As you say, batteries are still rather expensive, but it's exciting to see, and sorry to use the obvious example, but Tesla over the last year, and particularly with their new partnership with SolarCity, they're really pushing the battery technology for microgrids and for solar. And so You know, it's difficult to know, but I think over the next couple of years we're seeing things change quickly, and I'm hoping for some big breakthroughs. One of the reasons that I find it so interesting working in the island regions, and I know we're going to come on to talk about that a little bit later, is that I'm working in some countries where the electricity costs are 3 or 4 times higher than the US. And so batteries in those countries are already economically viable, and these countries are really leading the way in terms of embracing them. I think it's going to be a few years before they're economically mainstream in the US, but we're heading in the right direction.
Absolutely. And thanks for your comment. We do try to bring on a wide variety of energy experts because, you know, we need to get power to people. And so that's what we want, to help educate people on how to do that and the best way to go about that process. And that's why your stuff is very fascinating. As far as the battery, just one more thing there. When I was at a conference last summer, and they had all these people talking about batteries way above my education level, just kind of really in depth on the battery discussion. And it was fascinating to see that, you know, when we step back, sometimes we don't think about all of the sheer brain power that's going into not just, you know, we think about Tesla, like you said, but there are academic professors around the globe that are trying to solve this problem. And so it's encouraging that it's not just, it's not just entrepreneurs who are out there doing it. They've got their space, and you've got, you know, the academic world that's got their space. And so I was really encouraged to see that it's a very collaborative effort to kind of work through this issue of how do we solve this battery problem? Because when you're looking at some of these microgrid solutions, at least what they're talking about in Africa now, like you said, this stuff changes so fast. This was last year. Maybe they've kind of solved some of these issues. That was still kind of their big concern. And so what do you see as far as the connection with industry and academia, that there is this partnership that's kind of where they're working together, where the research is coming out saying this is what we're finding, it's getting to the marketplace, and the marketplace is going and testing these ideas? Or is there still kind of a disconnect between where academia thinks it needs to be and where the marketplace is pushing it to be?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, and I'm not sure I'm the best qualified to answer that. But certainly, it's interesting to see those links between academia, government investment, and where that's going, and then the private sector. And I think, historically, there has been an emphasis on government investment and academia to really make the breakthroughs, and that's certainly been really important to getting to the stage we're at. But now, I think the technology has got to the point where private entrepreneurs and inventors are really taking the lead. And, you know, as we said with Tesla, and there are plenty of other companies, but that's the one we see the most in the media. There are all these different technologies. Now, the challenging thing for someone like me working in the sector is to know exactly, you know, which of these new technologies that are up and coming are going to be the breakthrough. A lot of the time, there is some great technology which can be, absolutely revolutionary, but the cost can be completely prohibitive. And so knowing which ones are going to be both, you know, technologically viable and economically viable is going to be the challenge. And it really takes, it can be a leap of faith sometimes for companies to invest in these new products. So that's why things can sometimes take longer. I think that answered the question.
So let's kind of get into your company and what's going on. Give us it's a nonprofit organization, as we know. So give us the 30,000 foot view of, you know, what you guys do and kind of how this came about.
Yep. So we bring together the nonprofits, governments, and private sector to try and really push solar as a mainstream solution for energy. And, you know, often people think of solar, they think of renewable energy, and they immediately associate with climate change. But actually, what we want to do is show that, you know, there are far more reasons to use solar than just climate change. And in many parts of the world, solar is the most economically viable solution. So one interesting piece of research that I like to cite is a professor from Yale University. And he looked into solar and the reasons why people install it, and actually found that the biggest indicator in America, regardless of race, of region, of income, anything else, the biggest indicator of someone installing solar is whether their next door neighbor does it first. And I think that's a fantastic insight into human psychology, of people waiting for someone to prove the technology to them until they really want to embrace it themselves. But what we thought with that was, well, you know, we have a limited fund of money that we can invest. Where can we put the most prominent solar installations that can really show people that solar is there and that people are using it? And the campaign originally came with a petition asking President Obama to put solar panels on the White House. And the solar panels on the White House have a really interesting history, because Jimmy Carter originally put the panels, solar water heaters, up there back in, I guess that was the 70s. I'm not so good on my American political history. And those solar water heaters were taken off by Ronald Reagan, who said something along the lines of solar wasn't a becoming source of energy for a president. And I thought that was really interesting, that political dynamic. So President Obama has or did install 4 kilowatts of solar. So not a lot, probably enough to power the Oval Office, but that's about it. But there was some powerful symbolism in the American president making an installation like that. And we took that idea worldwide and said, okay, we really want to work with governments and encourage them to install solar energy on, you know, the White House equivalent in whichever country, whatever makes sense locally. And as you said, we've had a focus recently on the island countries in the Caribbean, which has been a really interesting place to work, because the Caribbean is facing some of the highest electricity prices in the world. Some islands are paying up to 50, 60 US cents per kilowatt hour, which compares to about, you know, between 8 and 15 cents in the US. So 4 or 5 times the price. And islands like Jamaica are paying, you know, between 30 and 40 cents per kilowatt hour. So there's a real need there to find an economical electricity source, particularly when the average income in Caribbean countries is, you know, depending on the island, half to a third to a quarter of US income. So we've been working there to work out how can we push solar energy, and how can we show that somewhere like the Caribbean, which already has so much sun, can use solar energy as their solution. And there's a lot of really interesting work happening with renewable energy there.
No, you bring up a great point. And as someone who's worked in oil and gas and has worked in various energy sectors, one of the things that I always, when I hear about renewables, I'm always curious to see, okay, well, where is oil and gas in the process? But here, I mean, I'm not an expert on these islands and what kind of, you know, natural resources they have as far as oil and gas goes. I'd imagine it's not very much, if at all. And so this is a very simple solution that would seem to fit in well with kind of how their normal everyday life goes. The other question I would have is on this is, how does wind energy tie in? Because, you know, with all the being surrounded by water, you'd imagine there's a lot of wind potential there as well. Are y'all coupling that with your solar, or is it just strictly a solar is kind of taking the place of wind in these spots, or what's going on there?
No, wind is definitely a solution that people are looking at. And, you know, the other one that sometimes people bring up is tidal or wave energy as well. And I guess the advantage that solar has over all of those is that for a big wind farm, it's really all or nothing. You have to, you know, even a small wind turbine requires a lot of groundwork and a big investment. And solar, you can really do in an incremental process of having, you know, small amounts of panels put on individual houses. And one of the biggest barriers in the Caribbean to investment in renewable energy is that having the finances to make the initial investment. And so wind is often prohibitive for those reasons. There are definitely projects, Aruba and I think Jamaica, as well as Fiji in the Pacific, do have wind farms. And those islands with larger grids are definitely looking into that. But often it's just been, you know, a large wind farm can be such a big investment that it's been too difficult to organize. And actually solar, in terms of the availability there, solar in the Caribbean really is a better resource. There's more sun energy available often and more consistently than wind energy. In regards to, I mentioned marine energy as well, that's a really interesting one, and there's been a lot of research in the North Atlantic and places like Scotland and Norway on that potential. But that's something that often people ask me about, but it doesn't really have the same potential in somewhere like the Caribbean. It needs those stormy places like the North Atlantic. With regards to your other point, yes, the Caribbean does not have many natural resources. And in fact, another reason why this is so pressing is traditionally the Caribbean has relied on Venezuela as its main source of oil through an initiative called Petrocaribe, where islands were tied into only buying their oil from Venezuela. Now, given the current political situation and the collapse of the Venezuelan economy, that's a very difficult position to be in. And so islands are looking to diversify themselves away from that. The one exception that does have a lot of natural resources is Trinidad and Tobago, which have huge oil resources and also big gas resources. And I believe Trinidad and Tobago, despite only being a country of 1.5 million people, is the, or at least one of the biggest supplier of natural gas to, I guess that would be LNG, to the United States. So, but on the whole, though, no, islands don't have those natural fossil fuel resources.
Okay, so what is the long-term goal here when we look at these islands? Are you looking to get down into every kind of household, or is it just to start with the government and then, you know, maybe get into the commercial sector and supply energy there? Or how far does this program, where does it start for you guys, and where does it end with your program?
So there are lots of different programs working on various sectors of the Caribbean energy market. And we're working very much on the public education side and the policy side with governments, also a little bit on providing local training. And there are various barriers that vary from country to country. One is that some of these countries may only have 40,000, 100,000 people in. Some, like Jamaica, are a bit larger, 4 million, but still the size of a US state. And often there's a lack of local resources and local knowledge. I mean, when you have 100,000 people in a country, there are just not enough people that have the, you know, a variety of training in certain areas. So building up training in renewables has been something that we're really interested in doing. Obviously, our installations on the Parliament building or local equivalent of the White House are more aimed at kind of public education and media attention towards solar. But there are other people working from all different angles in trying to build investment. And so a lot of what we're doing is trying to bring all those people that are sometimes siloed in their different areas together to work together, and also bring attention from American companies that might not realize the market potential of the Caribbean right on their doorstep. But unfortunately, one barrier which continues is that when you have such small jurisdictions, they have very, very different laws. You can go from one island to another, and there can be quite different regulations. And so when you only have 100,000 people, it's quite a lot of small fragmented markets. And that's a continuing challenge for investors in that region.
And one thing you've loosely touched on there, but I think is really important, is when you guys come in and you start setting up your solar panels, and even if it's just at the big government level, so, I mean, little government in this case, but the government level, that requires someone that can work on these and that can fix them. So you're creating, maybe not a lot of jobs, but you are creating jobs. And as these people go through this process, it allows, like you said, for people who come in and can be entrepreneurs and say, hey, I want to invest in this island here. And then the local talent is there to work with them and to service them. So it seems to me that maybe, even though this is kind of the early stages, it sounds like 3, 5, 7 years from now, there will be people on the ground who can maintenance these panels and can work with them and understand it. And so it's actually going to create a lot of potential opportunity as we kind of go down this process.
Yeah, for sure. So last year we were partnered with the government of St. Lucia, which is in the Eastern Caribbean, has a population just under 200,000 people, and their government are really committed to renewable energy. The average person is paying 38 cents per kilowatt hour for their electricity, and so people are really suffering through these high electric bills there. Somewhere like St. Lucia and most of the Caribbean, everyone has access to electricity. There are quite well-established grids, so it's not an electrification issue. It's just the price of electricity can be so prohibitive. That's quite different to somewhere like Haiti, where maybe less than a third of the people will have access to electricity, and similar to Uganda and other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. But St. Lucia was really interesting because we partnered with the government. We installed a small installation on the government house, the official residence of the Governor General, so equivalent to the White House. And we worked with a local company that are kind of a startup, a young guy who's really building his business and wants to do more solar. And we used this as an opportunity to train some of his team, who were very qualified electricians and construction people, but hadn't as much experience in solar. So we gave them some training, and also gave this guy who had a local startup called Noah Energy in St. Lucia a chance to talk on the radio, talk in the media, and get his company's name out there. And it's been great because since that installation, he's been inundated with phone calls of people making inquiries about having solar on their own homes. And so it does show that a lot of the times it's just a lack of knowledge, and particularly when there aren't that many existing installations in a place, that can stop people from uptaking. And as soon as people realize how much money they can save in these places with solar, particularly when they can feed back into the grid and don't need batteries, then you know, the market can take off quite quickly.
Right, and I don't want to get into economics lesson here, but you know, as you're, what you're basically saying is that if the homeowners can save money, well, that's good for the economy down there in general, because they can, you know, they can take that money they're saving on energy, they can save it, they can send their kid maybe to college or, you know, save for retirement, and so the standard of living goes up. So it's really, you know, it's more than just about solar energy. If you kind of step back and look at the whole picture, because this as it gets, you know, embedded into the ethos of these islands, it's really going to have long lasting impacts, because the power goes down. And so it's I think it's a great program. And I've got to ask now, you're working in these really tough to work locations, and I'm using the air quotes here. Where are you guys going next, or can you tell me that information?
Yeah, so we're hopefully by the end of May, we'll be completing an install in partnership with the government of Jamaica, so on the Prime Minister's residence in Jamaica. And that's a really exciting place. There's a lot going on there. And the government have committed to 30% renewable energy by 2030. So it's a big leap from going, you know, most of these islands right now are generating their electricity entirely from diesel generators, even somewhere with a more established grid. And so that's such an expensive way of generating electricity. You know, coal and nuclear and other things that you can do en masse just aren't possibilities, because they haven't got the they haven't got the economies of scale. There aren't enough people to buy the electricity. So they're going from this diesel generation and really committing towards renewables. So I'm hopefully heading out to Jamaica in May, which I'm really looking forward to. That'll be a new experience to me. And the government there, as I said, are really pushing this. One issue that the local utility are having in Jamaica, and this applies across the Caribbean, is that as battery prices are falling, people are starting to take themselves off grid, and the utilities are really suffering. Now, I raised that while talking about Jamaica, because the university in Kingston, the biggest university in Jamaica, University of the West Indies, have just announced this month that they plan to take themselves entirely off grid and generate their own electricity in their own microgrid. And so issues like that are going to be really pressing for the utility in Jamaica. And you know, if this big customer, whole university, are taking themselves off grid, it sets a precedent for a lot of private companies and private homeowners to start doing that, and even more so as battery technology gets cheaper.
Now, we could do, I think, a whole episode on, you know, emerging economies, and will they ever be on the grid versus, you know, the first world quote unquote countries, and how they will, you know, get off the grid and what's going to happen there. I think that is a fascinating discussion that we're going to actually have to have as energy professionals in the next few years, because you are seeing a lot of discussion about, you know, if you get off the grid, what happens to the power company? You know, if a major player, like you said, in this Jamaica case gets off, well, can the rest of the people actually support the power company to keep it open and viable? So there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and I know we don't have time to really dive into that today. But one final thing before I let you go, is there anything that you'd like to plug, promote? And I can't say anybody's going to feel bad for you. You're going to Jerusalem, you're going to Jamaica, you work in the Caribbean, so you're not going to get a lot of sympathy with the audience, but maybe tell us something more awesome that you're going to be doing here the next few months.
Yeah, well, I've been quite fortunate with the travel recently, and obviously the Caribbean's a fantastic place to work. So I appreciate that. I just encourage people to check out our website, www.solarheadofstate.com. .org, and hopefully you'll be able to link that in the info. And I'm more than happy to get in touch with people who are interested in the Caribbean as a market, or the work that we're doing. So you can get in touch with me through our website.
Absolutely. And we'll link to that, your website, and the Forbes 30 Under 30 article as well, so people can find out more about you. Well, look, thank you so much for your time. You've been gracious to us this morning, and fascinating stuff you guys have going on. We wish you the best of luck, and hope to have you on again in the future.
Thanks so much for having me, Ryan.
Thanks again to James for coming on. Really, really enjoyed the content there. Guys, quick reminder, our Trump 100-Day Energy Roundtable will be coming out the week of May the 3rd. Do not forget to check that out. As more details come available, we will release them to you. This month's book giveaway is again on the website, globalenergymedia.com, and you can go and see what it is. I'm not going to tell you. It's a surprise. So go check it out. Until next time, keep climbing.
Thanks for listening to the Global Energy Leaders Podcast, powered by R Squared Global.